Hi, and welcome to the Friday Coffee Meetup podcast for Friday, January 10th, 2020. On today's episode, we'll hear from Nicholas Stein on Practical Mindfulness, Resolution to Meditation. The Friday Coffee Meetup podcast is brought to you by Echo Factory, a Pasadena-based marketing and advertising agency that specializes helping healthcare, consumer goods, clean tech, and aerospace companies achieve rapid, sustainable growth. Echo Factory CEO Mike Schaefer is a co-founder and organizer of Friday Coffee Meetup. If you're interested in how Echo Factory can help your company achieve rapid, sustainable growth, you can learn more at echo-factory.com. Every week, the Friday Coffee Meetup brings together innovators, startups, investors, tech companies, and entrepreneurs at the cross-campus co-working space in Pasadena. You can learn about upcoming meetups and how you can attend in person at FridayCoffeeMeetup.com. Now, here's Nicholas with this week's presentation.
Thank you. I'm going to try to navigate the microphone and the clicker. We'll see how we do. I'm just going to jump right in. I have a lot of information to give you, and my story is in there too, and we want to do some meditations. So we'll just start right here, which is this. This looked familiar to anybody. I don't know if anybody was here. That was back in 2017, and that was my first time, and it was a wonderful thing. I love this meetup. It's always so supportive and so intelligent. So then I did it again last year, and then I did it again the year before that, and now here we are. We're fully back where we started. So it is an honor to do it here and to do it for the fourth time. There is a sense of why kick off the year with a mindfulness talk. I think it's obvious that a lot of people really have been thinking about doing it. Those who have done it have often quit and want to get back on the wagon. It's a really important thing that affects every part of your life. So let's look at the word resolution. It's a firm decision to do or not do something, right? And here's the typical ones that you'll see. And here are actual Twitter resolutions in 2020 that I found online. This is some of my favorites. It was my New Year's resolution to lose 15 pounds. I still have 35 to go. My New Year's resolution is to take more naps. My New Year's resolution is just give up. Very motivated, starting early. And then finally, my New Year's resolution is to regain my attention span. And I thought, this may be funny, but actually it works perfectly with what I'll be talking about. So today, we'll take a practical look at the benefits of mindfulness using secular meditation. And I'm going to tell you, that's what we're going to do. Here's what we're not going to do. We're not going to talk about crystals. We're not going to learn mantras. And we're not going to learn about chakras, all of which are fine. I just don't know anything about them. But and if you all, whatever your practice you have or anything else, I don't mean no disrespect. It's just my expertise doesn't lie there. We are going to use my dog. This is Bodhi. And when you see Bodhi, most of the time it means we're going to have an experiential a meditation piece. So that will start out right away. So let's make sure we're really here. I mean, I can see everybody's physically, bodies are here, but your mind could be anywhere. So let's let Bodhi introduce us here. So we're going to do a very quick one. I often call this a non-meditation because I'm not going to really give you much instruction. What I'm going to do is time 1 minute. And what we're going to do is have everybody just get comfortable, get sort of settled in. And what I want you to do is simply observe. You have a million thoughts going on anyway, and mostly you're just swimming in them, and you don't even know you're having them. And now what I want you to do is stop and just for 1 minute sit and listen and observe and watch and see where these thoughts are, where you're at this morning. And this is the beginning of our practices, just to observe and to bring our attention to it. So 1 minute, here we go. trying to coordinate a bell, a microphone, and a clicker. All right, so let me just ask Amy, what was going through your mind?
A lot of nothing?
All right. So you dropped in pretty good. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure a lot of you had to-do lists that you were working on. And, you know, the thing is, again, the difference between thinking and knowing that you're thinking is a vast difference. And this is what we really want to talk about. We don't want to get out of automatic pilot. We want to really begin to understand what's happening in us, what's happening around us, and we'll get more into that. So that was first. Thank you for that. So this is what I mean, observation and attention really equals awareness. And that's a key word. All three of these are key words to mindfulness. Mindfulness can pull us out of our autopilot trance and drop us into what's happening right now in real time. And that really, that word trance is interesting. You know, if you go into a room and you see people meditating, it looks like maybe they're in a trance. But really, the opposite is true. If you see a hairy person walking down the street, they're the one in the trance because they're lost in their thoughts. They have absolutely no idea. And their thoughts are coming from every direction, every which way. They don't know where they come from. They don't know where they go. Someone who is meditating, who may appear to be in a trance, actually is becoming more awake and more aware. So it's easier said than done to do this, mindfulness. But it, in my new book, my forthcoming book, my book that's being written right now, I try to use metaphors, of course, to which all meditation teachers do, to try to explain some of it. So what I tell people is that if you really look closely and you're really honest with yourself, it's a three-ring circus in there. And the difference between being in the circus, whether you're actually just a clown, or being up in the stands is quite a difference, because this is the same mind that I've got is the same mind that you have. People say to me all the time, Nick, I can't meditate because my mind races constantly. And I look at them and I say, what do you think my mind does? What do you think their mind does? I mean, as human beings, this is how we're wired. And a lot of it has to do with survival, which is a longer talk when I have more time. But it really is something that we are, it's a legacy of our Homo sapien background. So it's a circus, and it's good to know it's a circus, okay? It's good to remember it's a circus, and to forgive yourself for having a circus in your mind. And then you have, of course, monkey mind. This is the way that a lot of people have described it that goes back eons. So the monkey mind is obviously what it sounds like, too. It's a circus out in the jungle, and you really, all the things that are happening in your mind are such that it feels like you can't get away from it, because the monkey never sleeps. But what you need to do is befriend the monkey. You need to give the monkey a banana. You need to make friends with the monkey, because the monkey ain't going away. Either you know it's there or you have no idea it's there and you're just tugged and pulled along. So at its core, mindful meditation is a secular training that optimizes an invaluable commodity, which is your attention. It's really attention training. I have used this flashlight in a dark room, and if I shined it up here, we all would have our, say I've shined it at that speaker in a dark room, we'd all have our attention there. If I shine it to this speaker, we'd all have it there. So that's what the mind really does. You know, there's no such thing as really multitasking. It's putting our attention in serial form. So I have a string on this flashlight. I've done it even in an observatory, which is really dark. And I've done the demonstration. And then I've taken the string and I've swirled it around, flashlight going like this. And everybody goes, yeah, that's my mind. So, but it's something that you can really work on. So here's the thing. Where do we put our attention? Our attention is always, not always, but so much of the time in what's already happened or what may happen. It's incredible that people don't realize that this present moment is the only time you actually have. There is no other time. There's no other time to live your life. If you're always toggling back and forth between the past and the future, you're not in the present moment. You're not aware. You're missing your life. You're sleepwalking. So that's something that we're going to talk about as well. So here's what we really want to do. You've heard it many times, to be here now, in the present moment, in the here and now. But it's not as easy and not as simple as that sounds. It really takes some effort. And so we'll talk about where it comes through. There's no sleepwalking through your life. What I want you to do is yield to the present moment and learn how to do that through a variety of ways. So the classic definition of mindfulness is this. It was brought to us by Jon Kabat-Zinn, the father of secular mindfulness. And that's him, and he's sort of my hero. His book changed my life. But here's what he says. Mindfulness is learning to pay attention to the present moment on purpose. That's a key thing. It's not something like, oh, yeah, I'm paying attention. No, it's really on purpose. It's intentional in specific ways with openness, curiosity, and non-judgment. So this is a notion that speaks to the fact that we are conditioned people who have opinions about everything. You can walk down the street and test this for yourself. They're too fat, they're too tall, they're too skinny, they're too this, they're, you know, they got money, they don't got money. You're just sizing up everything. It's the kind of thing like we're an opinion-making machine. So what we're asking for is to stop, drop into the present moment, and just let it be. Just try to see your own prejudices and your own conditioning. And that way you'll see the world more afresh. So I'm going to give you a quick introduction to Jon Kabat-Zinn via Anderson Cooper, and this will explain a lot.
Our lives are filled with distractions. Email, Twitter, texting. We're constantly connected to technology, rarely alone with just our thoughts. Which is probably why there's a growing movement in America to train people to get around the stresses of daily life. It's a practice called mindfulness, and it basically means being aware of your thoughts, physical sensations, and surroundings. Tonight, we'll introduce you to the man who's largely responsible for mindfulness gaining traction. His name is Jon Kabat-Zinn, and he thinks mindfulness is the answer for people who are so overwhelmed by life, they feel they aren't really living at all.
There are a lot of different ways to talk about mindfulness, but what it really means is awareness.
Is it being present?
It is being present. That's exactly what it is.
I don't feel I'm very present in each moment. I feel like every moment I'm either thinking about something that's coming down the road or something that's been in the past.
So ultimately, all this preparing is for what? For the next moment, like the last moment, like, and then we're dead. So in a certain way, are we
depressing.
Going to experience while we're still alive? We're only alive now.
Jon Kabat-Zinn is an MIT-trained scientist who's been practicing mindfulness for 47 years. Back in 1979, he started teaching mindfulness through meditation to people suffering from chronic pain and illness. That program is now used in more than 700 hospitals worldwide.
So how can you be mindful in your daily life?
When your alarm goes off and you jump out of bed, what is the nature of the mind in that moment? Are you already like, oh my God, your calendar pops into your mind and you're driven already? Or can you take a moment and just lie in bed and just feel your body breathing and remember, oh yeah, brand new day and I'm still alive. So I get out of bed with awareness, brush my teeth with awareness. When you're in the shower next time, check and see if you're in the shower.
What do you mean check and see if you're in the shower?
Well, you may not be. You may be in your first meeting at work. You may have 50 people in the shower with you.
Kabat-Zinn says mindfulness takes practice. A lot of people start with a training class to learn how to meditate.
So if you didn't know about John before, you do now. He's an extraordinary man, and he's the one who was a molecular scientist at MIT who was also a Buddhist, and he realized that if it stayed as a Buddhist practice, it would travel nowhere. And today it travels to places like this, the Seattle Seahawks, cops, who I teach a lot of law enforcement, CEOs. He sort of freed it to the larger thing. So obviously what he said was meditation is a way to get to mindfulness. So what we're doing is we're practicing mindfulness on the couch. This is the way I like to describe it. Meditation is like concentrated mindfulness, and we're going to do some right after this. And what I mean by that is we're going to make a real purposeful situation where we sit in the chair, we get drop into our bodies, and we start to find a point of focus. And many people will think the point of focus is always the breath, but it's not. There are many points of focus. We may use the breath as a classic one. And what happens is there's nothing special about the breath per se. It's just a standard. And so you can then focus on your breath. That's where you're telling yourself you're going to put your attention. That's when you're in charge. And you'll see what happens to your mind. It wants to pull away. It wants to tell stories. It wants to go all over the place. It wants to go in the future, in the past. But you wake up to that, and you come back to the breath. And what that does, it builds the muscle of mindfulness. It's attention training. You're actually willing yourself to come back to the thing you've decided to work on. So we'll try that very soon. Mindfulness is like expanded meditation. This is like when I have a cup of coffee in the morning, I'm really having the cup of coffee. This is when I'm having lunch with my friend, I'm really focused on my friend. Or sometimes I'm driving in my car, and I'll suddenly feel my hands on the wheel, and I'll look around, and I'll take a real moment to be in the present. So the biggest misconception about meditation, I would normally ask you, but I'll tell you the answer because we're running out of time, is this. Somehow that you must clear your mind and empty it of all thoughts. If there's one thing you take away from today, know that this is wrong. And anyone who teaches this is not doing you any favors. You cannot get rid of your thoughts. And if you try, you're just going to have more thoughts. It absolutely is nothing that we do. As a matter of fact, what we do is this. It's about changing your relationship to your thoughts, seeing them for what they really are, which is like 70,000 a day. So the next thought is just like the last thought. It really doesn't have to be held too tightly or given too much import until you're really on task, until you really need to do something specific. And this is John again. You can't stop the waves, but you can learn how to surf. So, you know, you can't go down to the beach and stop the waves. It really is a changing, a fundamental changing of your relationship to your thoughts, which I don't know if anything could be more primary and foundational than that. So let's do our meditation here. We'll see how far we get. This is a classic concentration meditation with an anchor. So get yourself situated again. Here's what you find out all the time. I mean, this is what people tell you all the time. Be in the present moment. Be in the present moment. Be in the present moment. It's become a cliche, frankly. I mean, it's used so often that people don't even know what it means, and after a while, it has no meaning for it. So I decided to do something about that, and you guys get to be one of the first people to find out what I've done about it. How can you really be more mindful in everyday life? How can you take what you learn on the cushion and bring it into your everyday life? Well, it's not easy. I mean, even today, if I half a dozen times, if I really get mindful, I count myself as a good day. So it's not easy to remember. But I figured out a new way of explaining it, which is more instructional and more specific. So the word is drop, open, go, see, equals what? Once again, dogs. That seems to be the theme of the day, right, Wayne? Really does. So there's my dog to help with that. And this is what it means. Drop into your body. So this is what I'm saying. When you are in a place where you don't know what to do with yourself and you're just waiting around for something to happen, drop into your body. Open to your five senses. Really be open. Like, for instance, right now, I can see all of you, and I can see somebody working on the computer at the back of the room. I can listen, and I can hear the air conditioner, right? I can smell, all these things. It's almost like a superpower. It's like, you know, my God, I've got vision. I can see way over here. I can hear things that I never thought I should pay attention to. Now, this is the tricky part. Go to the front of your mind. And that really means to go to the part of your mind, which is your real human part of your mind, your prefrontal cortex. And that's a way to tell yourself to concentrate, to do this on purpose. You're not doing this mindfulness sort of as a sidebar. You're doing this on purpose. And then see your thoughts. Because just because you get mindful and get into the moment doesn't mean you stop thinking. So you want to do that. So that's dogs. And here's a perfect time to do it. Well, this is the prefrontal cortex. This is really where all of our serial thinking is, our executive function. This is the front of your mind is where it is the last part that evolved in human beings. This is where we are human. So here's the perfect chance. This will be your assignment. The next time you're at the grocery store, which is probably going to be later today or tomorrow, when we all go to the grocery store, we start shopping and getting all the stuff we want, and then we come down to the checkout lines and we survey the entire battlefield. And we immediately try to figure out what is the fastest line, and we really go through a lot of mental calculations because we know we're going to be miserable if we don't. So then we do it. We find the fastest line, and instantly we know it's the slowest line because there's some lady in front of us, there's some checkout gal who's too chatty or something who by somebody wants to run off and get another item and so on and so forth. And at that moment, you know, the watching the mind is really funny because what could be more inconsequential than freaking yourself out and beating yourself up, oh, I'm such an idiot, I got in the wrong line, than this, a few more minutes of your life. So this is what I want you to do, dogs. I want you to drop into your body, open to your senses, D-O-G, go to the front of your mind and survey your thoughts. I do it. It works. It's really, next thing you know, you're in the miracle of a supermarket. The sights, the sounds, the abundance. And most people here can really buy anything they want in a supermarket. It's not like you're going in to buy a Tesla. So, you know, it's really quite a miracle. And if you've traveled around the world enough, you know that a modern-day American supermarket is unbelievable. So I'll stop here. I have plenty more to tell you, but this is always such a tight schedule. But I'll answer any questions you have. But don't forget dogs.
Yay, dogs. Thank you, Nick. We're going to take some Q&A now. John is going to go around with the mic. So I think everybody knows the rules here. We want a question, right? A short sentence with a question mark at the end. Now's not the time to tell your stories about dogs or your lack of meditation. So with that, John, go ahead and answer some questions, Nick.
Hi, Nick. Thank you so much for the dogs. And when I saw the description of this meetup, I was really intrigued by your experience on the Mexican border. Yes. And how it inspired you to do meditation. And I saw you skipped this section. Right. Could you pay a little bit of time to this?
All right. I'll tell you the story quickly without the slides. It is always hard to know the perfect mix between my backstory, how I got to mindfulness and teaching mindfulness itself. And the format here is very quick. So bottom line is I've been a nonfiction television producer for 40 years. And I've worked for all the networks and I've worked for all the cable networks and I've done a million things. And then some of my colleagues from that world are here today, which is great. The last big show I did was called Border Wars, and it was on the National Geographic Channel. And it was the best of times, and it was the worst of times. It was as intense as anything you can do. We spent our time embedded with law enforcement, and we spent our time riding in Blackhawks, jumping out of Blackhawks, on the back of horses, back of ATVs. We would patrol the Rio Grande River in patrol boats. We lived the life. It was a huge hit. It was the highest rated premiere in the history of the National Geographic Channel, and for a while, their highest rated series. And so we got shot out of a cannon. And as a result, you know, they suddenly wanted more programs and more programs and more programs. And it just sort of ate my life. By the time I kind of did a figuring out how much time I was away from home, for instance, it was about 70% of the time for 4 years. Because I was at the border, I'd be home for a week, I'd go to New York where we're cutting the show, down to D.C., which is the National Geographic headquarters, and the headquarters of Customs and Border Protection, and ICE, and DEA, and everybody else. We saw tremendous suffering down there, huge amount of suffering, as you all know, and it really affected me and my crew. For me particularly, I got into kind of a burnout stage, and it was enhanced by corporate burnout. The story that most people don't know is the National Geographic was owned by Fox, 21st century Rupert Murdoch Fox. And there was a firewall between between the editorial side where I worked and the business side. And that firewall came down in a corporate takeover. Really, it was a hostile takeover from our business partner. And almost all of my colleagues got fired. So it was a really intense experience. And I'm out in McAllen, Texas, reading emails about my direct reports are all getting fired. So I come back and I think, all right, we're done. We had done 50 episodes. So, you know, I didn't want to be greedy, for God's sakes. I mean, I've been on lots of shows that never got close to that. So I thought, well, I'll be fired. We'll be canceled. That's fine. But it turned out the new president, who was about 15 years old, or it seemed that way, had the attention span of a gnat, decided he loved Border Wars and wanted to renew it for a new season. So I thought, okay, well, that's good. Except he had a little surprise for me. He knew he could make it better. So he hired a buddy of his to be my boss. And my job was to train my new boss. So if you want to talk about an ego-crushing experience, that's pretty much it. And then I got down to the border again in this horrible way. And my guns and drugs and money and weapons and violence were now mixed with anger and resentment and bitterness and depression and anxiety. This was not a good brew. This was a bad brew. And so I crawled away from Border Wars, and I made my way to Canada, which is a longer story, to get another job. And I was a mess. I was a real hot mess. My marriage was falling apart. And I thought my career was over in my mind. And I faked my way through this new job in Canada, Montreal. And then finally, my therapist kept telling me, you know, I'm an LA guy, so I had my therapist on Skype. And he said, Nick, you got to try mindfulness. I said, that's all that breathing crap? I don't want to do that stuff. He said, dude, I'm an atheist. I'm not doing that. And finally said, you really should. Finally, I went and bought the book, John Kabat-Zinn's book. And I started meditating in my tiny apartment. And after the first week, I got something I hadn't seen in a long time, which was hope. And a sense of groundingness and a sense of coming home. Like really coming home to myself. So the rest is history, only in the sense that I went back and started teaching cops. And I actually got back to McAllen, Texas, and taught Border Patrol, which was an incredible journey, full circle. And today I teach cops. I teach in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And I'll tell you this, don't tell anybody, because we're still putting the final touches on it. But John Kabat-Zinn, who I formed a relationship with, has recommended me to the New York City Police Department. So I'm doing that in March.
Thank you for sharing your story. I started learning about meditation about 2 years ago, and I'm absolutely sold on the benefits of mindfulness meditation, everything you just said. But the thing I struggle with is routine. I kind of keep setting these resolutions like 5 days this week or 10 days in a row, and I consistently find myself not being able to do it. Right. What are your thoughts about really getting into the routine or some techniques to do that?
Right.
Not fail, keep failing at it.
No, that's a great question. And actually, the very end of my slideshow talks about all that, so I'll tell you verbally about it. The easiest thing in the world to quit is your meditation practice. It can be prioritized very low on the totem pole. And it's ironic because the more you send it down the totem pole, the more you need it. There's an old saying that if you're too busy to do 10 or 20 minutes of mindfulness meditation a day, you should do an hour. But I don't want to scare anybody off with thinking you got to do 10 or 20 minutes. As a matter of fact, we all believe that frequency trumps duration every time. So even if you do 5 minutes a day, really, honest to God, and you do it every day or you try to do it every day, that's going to make a benefit and you're going to see it over time. What I say is try to do it every day because that way you'll get it in 3 or 4 a week, right? Now, the other big hint is make a space in your home or your apartment or wherever you live. Really make a meditation spot for yourself. And if you have a family, tell them, you know, this is your spot. And then go and do that. The other hint is try to do it in the morning. You can make time in the morning. You can get up 20 minutes earlier and make the time. And then if you don't do it in the morning, you're chasing it all day. When am I going to do it? Oh, I can't do it now. You get home, you're exhausted, right? You're making dinner and so forth. If there's anybody here who works inside a company or a corporation, a bigger company, ask them to give you a quiet room. Every corporation in America should have a quiet room, some place that people can decompose. That's not the right word. Can de-stress. I mean, whether you go into the quiet room and meditate or whether you just go in the quiet room and collect your thoughts, it's great because then you're being encouraged to push away from your computer and on the company dime, do something that's healthful for yourself. So there's all these things. The other things is, as I say at the end of this lecture that you're not going to see, apps, books, podcasts, and groups. All of them are really important. Meditating by yourself is a singular experience and can be kind of lonely. We live in the 21st century. We have the most incredible resources. You can, you know, I'm a meditation teacher, but you can listen to John Kabat-Zinn or Joseph Goldstein or Sharon Salzberg or Dan Harris, and you really get some fine teaching there. And they're just a click away. The best app that I want to recommend is Dan Harris's app, particularly if you're in the early stages. It's called 10% Happier. And if you like Dan Harris's shtick, and he does have some shtick, he's got the app, which is brilliant. He's got his podcast, which is every week, which also kind of enhances on the app. And he's got two books out. The first book, 10% Happier, is a great read. He was an ABC News correspondent and anchorman who burned himself out in Iraq and Afghanistan and other stressors of his career. And then he had a full-blown panic attack on live TV. And that's what kind of was kind of bring me to Buddha moment. And it took a while, but he's a great ambassador. And the last man on earth who said he would ever learn to meditate, and I think I'm the second last guy who ever said I would ever meditate. So that's some quick thoughts. Yes?
Thank you. Hi, Lake. Thank you for your sharing first.
Where are you?
It's here.
Oh, hi.
Hello. Sorry, I should stand up. My name is Vivian Lee. I have two questions I want to ask about meditation. Before I ask that, I want to share my understanding for meditation. About 7 years ago... Okay. So, philosophically, what is the differentiation between mindfulness meditation and the Buddha meditation? Because I did the research and 10-day retreats about Vipassana meditation is from Buddha, but in my master research is philosophical. And when I practice it, it does help for somatization stuff. And I don't know the differentiation yet. And second thing is, what is the effective way to practice mindfulness meditation? Okay. And through your sharing, I still having difficulty to understand that.
Okay. First of all, its roots in Buddhism is absolutely true. It comes from Theravada Buddhism, which is one of the oldest forms of Buddhism. Mindfulness is in the sutras. Mindfulness comes to us from that background. Now, meditation predates Buddha by a long time. You know, the Vedantics and so forth were meditating. Most of us who get into secular meditation, we come through the secular door because it makes sense, because it's science-based, because it is a logic to it which is almost irrefutable. But once we get through that door and we find it's helping our lives, you can't help but get curious about its roots, and you can't help but get curious about Buddhism. So, Buddhism is a complicated subject, and there are many forms of Buddhism around the world, from Japanese to Tibet, Nepal, obviously the American version, and so forth. So it's, I would say this, though, that I saw a T-shirt once that I really loved that said, Buddhism, Atheism. And I thought, what? Sure enough, the more I looked into it, it's not a religion. It can be practiced in a religious sort of way, but the Buddha, I think, more is like a doctor. He diagnosed the problem, and then he gave his prescription for it. And that's all I'll say at that right now. And then the last part I'm just going to hold off because we have another question back there.
So you said the Jon Kabat-Zinn book changed your life. He's got at least 15 books in English, not counting Spanish. So which book, or one,
right,
or two books?
Right. Again, the slide you're not going to see. Full Catastrophe Living. Have you heard of that one? Full Catastrophe Living is the Bible. It's a crazy title. I understand his publishers begged him not to call it Full Catastrophe Living because it's like, what the hell? Who wants to have a catastrophe? It's actually a quote from Zorba the Greek, and somebody said to Zorba, you know, you have 15 children and you have three jobs, and that must be insane. And he goes, why? I love my full catastrophe life. So the bottom line is our lives are full of catastrophes, tiny, small, medium-sized, big, and gigantic, and life-changing. So the catastrophe of life is life. You know, the human condition is hard. The human mind is wired for a time 200,000 years ago and plunked right down in the 21st century. You know, what we used to think was a threat to us, which was a rustle in the bushes, and you could only be wrong once, right? Because if the rustle in the bushes turned out to be a snake or a tiger, you were done. And so your entire nervous system kicks into gear at fight or flight or freeze. And your whole body changes. Your sex drive goes down. Your appetite goes away. You get tunnel vision. You get adrenaline and cortisol racing through your body. And you have to. This is automatic. You have no choice about it. And you flee or fight or freeze. Those same reactions can happen with an email dropping in as your inbox. I mean, that's what's happening to us. We get jacked and we don't come back down. And so John talks about all of this. He talks about, you know, the history and the meditation work that he's done. And here's one more thing I'll tell you. John started his whole thing. He started secular mindfulness in a pain clinic.
in a hospital at Worcester, Massachusetts, the University of Massachusetts. And he helped these people because they all had, at the end of their ropes, they had chronic pain, they had pain related to cancer, they had agoraphobia, they had anxiety, back pain, knee pain, headaches, you name it. And he finally, famously said to them, I cannot take away your pain any more than the doctors who have tried to help you at this point. But I can change your relationship to your pain. So that's the same thing as I said. We're changing our relationship to our thoughts. And what I want to say is we're all in a pain clinic. Life is a pain clinic. And so we don't have many tools. We really have very few tools. I tried drinking. That didn't work out so well. You know, there are a lot of ways we cope. We can watch TV all night long and think we're getting de-stressed. As a matter of fact, all you're getting is more jacked. So what would be the only true antidote to the insane digital life we have, to the tsunami of data that we never were supposed to take in this much information and this much complexity? The only rational counterweight is stillness, which is why I call my talk Strategic Stillness.
Oh, so you may have answered this already, but because we're all hardwired and you work with law enforcement and different people, what has been the most, in terms of the people you work with, impactful or the change that you have seen? And it may have been the stillness you talked about.
Right. Well, you know, I was in nonfiction TV for all those years, and I used to think my contribution to the world was going to be a great television series, you know, blue chip television series, and I was going to have millions of people would watch it, and therefore I was really helping people. Well, I don't hardly believe it now, you know. If you took one of my best documentaries and you gave people a quiz right after you turned the TV off, they'd fail every time. You know, there's something about television that just washes right over you, even the best shows. It's just this tsunami of information. So now the old cliche, if I could really just help one person, it'd be worth it. I thought that was such a hackneyed cliche until it started happening to me, until I actually taught people who started a meditation practice whose lives were changed. And it happens all the time. I'll give you one small anecdote. I was talking to these detectives in Cambridge, Massachusetts. We're talking 60 detectives, all carrying heat, you know, who see the worst part of humanity, stressed out of their minds, you know. More cops commit suicide than die in the line of duty. So it's just an incredible thing they do. And this guy was an older guy. I think his name was Joe. And he came up to me on the second day and he goes, Nick, I got to tell you, man, I took this. He had a strong Boston accent. He says, I went home. I told my wife there was this guy talking about meditation. He says, I really want to try it. He says, I'm going to wake up in the morning and I'm going to do it. And then, but we have a kid on the spectrum and it's really crazy, but I'm really going to do it. So I woke up the next morning. I woke up this morning. I did 8 minutes and it was fantastic. And my wife comes to me and she says, well, how was it? And I said, it was good. We should do this together. So anyway, we went on and talked about that. But I mean, a moment like that for me is just a moment makes me want to cry. You know, this is a guy who would never have thought about it and immediately understood how he needed it and how it could help him.
Nick, over here.
Ah.
Thank you for being here for a fourth year in a row now. I think this has been very helpful for a lot of people that listen to your talk. My question is, you said that you've written 4 books, right?
No. I'm writing one book.
Oh, you're writing a book. Okay, can you tell us
chapter 10. I'm on chapter 10.
Can you tell us a little bit about what this book is going to be about? Is it going to be about mindfulness or is it going to be about something else? And
yes, I will. there's a woman named Valerie Alexander who happens to be seated right there.
Right here.
And Valerie heard me talk and came to my monthly meditation group. And I didn't even really understand that Valerie was in the publishing business. I thought she was in the tech business until she said to me, you and I have to talk. She has this amazing series called As a Second Language, which is copyrighted those 4 words, As a Second Language, 4 words. And she's had now 5 or 6 books. She wrote 2, and she's gotten people like me to write others. And it's As a Second Language. So it's parenting as a second language, grief as a second language, creativity, happiness as a second language. And it's a beautiful format. And it works particularly well with mindfulness as a second language because it really feels like a second language. You know, when you acquire a new language, it opens your whole world up to a whole other way of thinking, a whole way of observing the world, and it broadens your horizons, and it also makes you think a lot more about, you know, who you are and how you're going to communicate. So mindfulness as a second language is going to be my book, Emerging. And the great thing about the format is that Valerie encourages us to insert our own voice in such a way that we actually insert anecdotes. So I give anecdotes from border wars, from teaching cops, to teaching in the Los Angeles County Men's Jail, where I teach people how to meditate in their cells, you know, all the way doing to the corporate work I do. So it all is grist for the mill, which is great, because everybody told me I should write a memoir, and I said, well, what should we call it, from border to Buddha, or immigration to meditation? And I'm so glad. I said I wasn't going to write a memoir, because who's going to read the thing? And secondly, this allows me to write a book about mindfulness, but also infuses it with my own take on the subject.
Great. Thank you, Nick. Let's say thank you to Nick for an amazing morning between us.
The Friday Coffee Meetup podcast is brought to you by Echo Factory. Learn more about how Echo Factory can help your business achieve rapid, sustainable growth at echo-factory.com. And get all the details about upcoming Friday Coffee Meetup episodes at fridaycoffeemeetup.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again next week.